Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lily Tuck, whose latest novel is The News from Paraguay, which won the National Book Award last year. Three earlier novels, Interviewing Matisse, The Woman Who Walked on Water in Siam, and a collection of short stories. Several short stories have appeared in The New Yorker and other magazines. The News from Paraguay is a broad-based novel dealing with a woman named Ella Lynch, who in the 1850s travels with her lover, her boyfriend, then never married, Franco Lopez, to Paraguay, where he becomes a vicious dictator. I understand that you like looking for obscure areas to write about. From what I discovered, you don't seem to remember quite where you first heard of her.
Right. I think I read a story quite a long time ago because I wrote a short story based on Francisco Solano Lopez and Ella Lynch 25 years ago, a story that I never published. So I think the story stayed in my head, and I think it's a compelling story.
You lived in South America when you were very, very young. Many of the women in your books, their lives are changed by, as you say, a physical displacement, which your own was. Right.
Right. I was born in France. Then when I was two, on account of World War II, my parents, who were originally German, had to leave France, and we went to South America. Actually, my father joined the French Foreign Legion for a while. My mother and I went to Peru. Eventually, he joined us. We spent the war years in Peru and Uruguay. Then we went back to France, and then eventually my mother and I came to the United States, and I was an only child. I did not have an unhappy childhood, but I certainly was always moving. I always was sort of one step behind everybody. I didn't speak the language of the country. I think the feeling of displacement and not being able to communicate is one of the main themes in my books.
There's a quote you give from the poet Paul Celan, in the air, that's where your roots are.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've always felt that way.
Right.
Then.
I do feel, I feel very much American. My children all live in the United States, but I do feel sort of rootless. I always wonder where I'm going to be buried, and I don't really care, actually, in the air.
When you were living in Peru and Uruguay, do you remember anything of those years?
I remember sort of childish details. I remember that I had a dog. I remember that our stove blew up. I remember getting stuck in an elevator. I remember going to school in Uruguay, and my real name is Lilian, not Lily. And suddenly there were three Lilianas in my class, and I was horrified because I thought I was the only Lilian in the whole world.
What did your father do?
My father was a movie producer, and he ended up living in Rome after the war and lived in Rome all the rest of his life.
Do we recognize any of the movies he produced?
No, unfortunately not, but they were good movies. Yeah, there was one wonderful movie called Three Girls from Rome.
So you were living in France, and France fell, and he got out at that point?
Mm-hmm. My father was interned in a camp. All Germans and Austrian men were interned the way we interned the Japanese. And the reason he was able to leave the camp and not be deported back to Germany, where he would have ended up, in a death camp, it was to join the French Foreign Legion. Meanwhile, my mother and I, we went first to Biarritz, then to Lisbon, and we, with lots of other refugees, waited for a boat to go to New York. But we didn't have a visa to stay in New York, so we went on to South America.
Did your mother ever talk about those years with you?
She didn't. My mother didn't want to be associated with Germany or be thought of as German, so she was very glamorous, and she just had this sort of middle European accent, and she was sort of mysterious about her provenance.
Your novel takes place from the 1850s into the 1870s. You've said that one of the difficulties in writing the book, once you decided to do it, was that your two primary characters, Ella and Francisco, known as Franco, are pretty evil.
Although I'm not of the school of writers that has to like their character or get very involved in their characters. I keep my distance, but at the same time, I have to find something that appeals to me about my main characters, and so I work pretty hard to find something nice about Ella. She was a courtesan in Paris, and then she had a love affair with an impecunious Russian count, and she had lots of debts. When Franco came along, he was the answer to her prayers, in a way.
He was the son of the president.
Right, 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 and very rich. Not unattractive, I don't think.
He brought her. How odd was that for the time, to bring your courtesan lover with you as your wife but never marry her?
His family disapproved of Ella Lynch, and also the diplomatic community disapproved of her. But at the same time, there were lots of sort of odd Europeans in Paraguay, sort of fortune hunters. And also Franco brought a lot of engineers and architects. He wanted to modernize and beautify, particularly the capital city, Asunción. He wanted, for instance, to build an opera house modeled on La Scala. So there were a lot of Europeans who came to Paraguay.
But it was pretty wild frontier country.
Yes, I think so. But Paraguay was always a very prosperous, peaceful country. They had the first telegraph system. I don't know whether it was the first train, railroad, but it wasn't a dangerous country. I think Argentina was much more dangerous with the gauchos and everybody fighting over land.
At that particular time, there was very little contact between the native inhabitants, the Indians, and the Spaniards who had moved in. Or was there? Had the intermixing really begun by that point?
I think the intermixing had begun. I think Paraguayans are incredibly democratic, and there wasn't a stigma attached to the Guarani Indians, really.
Lily Tuck, how did Paraguay begin?
It got its independence in 1815.
And down the coast was Uruguay. I had no idea that it had a different name, that it was called Banda Oriental.
Yeah.
They speak Spanish there, right?
Yes, yes.
So it was more related to Argentina than it was to Brazil.
Right.
Were these colonies playing out European politics at all, or was it so divorced from that that anybody could come over and be in, quote, the New World that way?
I think they were very divorced from European politics, but at the same time, there were a lot of people who came over. I mean, the Irish and the potato famine, English people who were being discriminated or sent away because of their religious faith, particularly Argentina and Uruguay. There were a lot of English who came over.
You chose to make this a novel, though you did a lot of research. Was there any thought on your part of keeping it nonfiction?
No.
When you were working on it, did you feel constrained by history at all?
Well, I think that was one of the big problems, was trying to get all the facts in, because, again, I think most people don't know very much about Paraguay. Most people I've spoken to don't even know where it is. So to get all the facts that are sort of complicated and unknown, that was one of the biggest constraints. But I think the story is so interesting that I didn't feel constrained by the actual story.
Well, the story itself concerns main characters. They go over there, and she's kind of his major advisor. Now, you seem to avoid most of her advising, political advising in the book. Was there a reason for that?
I wanted to show a different side of her. I wanted to show her as the lover, the mother, the horseback rider, the intrepid woman, but not sort of the politically involved woman.
Paraguay itself, is that more jungle?
No, it's marsh and desert. I mean, Paraguay is divided into two by the Paraguay River. On one side is the Gran Chaco, which is mainly marsh. It's completely without houses or villages or roads. When you go further north towards Bolivia, it's desert. The other part of Paraguay is sort of, again, it's not very densely populated. There's a lot of marsh. There's a lot of rivers and tributaries.
As of the writing of the book, you had not been to Paraguay. Have you been to Paraguay now?
Yes. I mean, it was this sort of life is always stranger than fiction, I think. After the book got the National Book Award, I had an email from the Minister of Tourism from Paraguay inviting me to come down. And I thought, why not? So I just went down for a week, and it was an amazing trip. Also amazing because, unbeknownst to me, people in Paraguay who think of the dictator Francisco Solano Lopez not as a tyrant or not as an evil despot, but as their hero, they were protesting my visit, and they also thought the book was disrespectful and, worse, pornographic. So suddenly there was all this controversy, and people were calling into radio stations and writing to the newspapers saying that Lily Tuck was persona non grata. And I got wind of this a little bit, and so it made me a little bit anxious. But actually, everything was fine. I had a bodyguard. I traveled with the great-grandson of Francisco Solano Lopez, a very, very nice man who was ambassador to Japan, Miguel Solano Lopez, and the Minister of Tourism, a PR person, photographer. I mean, it was an amazing trip.
The Paraguay you toured around, how close was that to the Paraguay of your imagination?
I think very, very different. I think modernity has come to Paraguay. Also, they took me around to all the battlefields that I describe, and 150 years ago, the battlefields were marshes, and now they're sort of old, dried-up fields, and I'm really very glad I didn't go first before I wrote the book, because I think my vision of what Paraguay looked like would have been muddied or clouded.
What did Solano Lopez think of the book?
The great-grandson. Yeah, no, he was totally on my side. He kept saying it was fiction. He thought it was very interesting that Paraguay was sort of being put back on the map because of the book. He was totally supportive. He was really very, very nice.
When you were there, you got none of that negative feedback?
No, I had a press conference the first night, and there were, I don't know, 30, 40 reporters who were there, and they all asked questions, particularly about the sort of sexual passages, and I kept saying that it was fiction. And that I was a grandmother and I had 10 grandchildren, and I wouldn't write anything that would shock my grandchildren. So I think everybody calmed down about it.
In this book, we follow Ella and Franco through his career as president. And as it goes on, he gets more and more vicious. Was that standard operating procedure for Latin America at the time, or was he particularly vile?
I think he was pretty vile, yeah. When you think that when the war started in 1865, there were 1 million people in Paraguay, and by the time the war ended, 1870, there were 200,000 people left. 800,000 people died.
Before we get to the war, yeah. I do want to ask you about the strange story that kind of appears almost as a parenthesis, about four paragraphs, of these French winemakers who were brought to Paraguay to start wineries up, and all of them died.
Yeah, I know. It was just, I mean, that was all completely mishandled. I mean, they were put in the Gran Chaco in marshes, and nobody organized anything for them, and they all perished. There are strange groups who have survived, who have come to Paraguay. For instance, Elizabeth Nietzsche, Frederick Nietzsche's sister, brought a group of Germans to Paraguay, and they're still there. And then there are some Mennonites in a city called Philadelphia who live in Paraguay. So I think Paraguay attracts a lot of offbeat groups.
You have fictional characters, Doña Inez. Is she a maidservant? What's her relationship to Ella?
Well, she was supposed to teach her Spanish.
Okay.
She was her Spanish teacher, and then she kind of disappears. But then she ends up being sort of the only person that really survives the whole saga, she and the horse.
There's a lot of material from a diary that Ella writes. That diary is completely fictional.
Right. The letters, the diaries, all of that is fictional.
But there are two actual diaries or books about it written by characters in your book. Mm-hmm. One is Masterman, who's a doctor, mm-hmm. and the other is Charles Washburn, who was mm-hmm. the ambassador from the United States.
Right. Those are real.
And yep. you use that material right. extensively.
Yeah, yeah.
Did Mrs. Washburn despise Ella?
I don't know. I don't know anything about Mrs. Washburn, but I would imagine that she would, yeah.
Why?
Well, because Ella was a courtesan, and I think the Washburns were probably, they were from New England, I think, from Maine, and they would probably not want to have anything to do with a courtesan.
The bulk of the book, News from Paraguay, Lily Tuck, the bulk of the book is about this war, with the Triple Alliance, I guess, being Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, Banda
right.
Oriental. Yeah. I was trying to think back on how it actually began. Why did Lopez actually find himself in this terrible war? It just seems like it started with a diplomatic squabble.
Exactly, it did. And Francisco Solano Lopez, I mean, first he felt that he was being ignored by the bigger countries. I think he felt that Paraguay wasn't respected enough. He wasn't respected enough. So he got more and more sort of upset about this, and he just used the incident of the boat going up the river to start a war, basically.
And eventually what happened is because he had just a limited number of a million people to work with, and he was up against three countries, they eventually just overthrew him.
Paraguay, when the war started, had a much larger army than any of the other countries. I think they had 80,000 soldiers, and they were very well organized. They'd gotten arms from Europe. Argentina was constantly having revolutions and was very disorganized as a country, as was Bande Orientale. And most of the soldiers from Brazil were slaves. They didn't particularly want to fight either.
By the end of the war, we had a situation that sounds a little bit like Iran, Iraq, children and old men fighting.
Yeah, and a completely pointless war, too. I mean, a war that could have been easily avoided and was based on Franco's hubris.
You're listening to an interview with Lily Tuck, whose latest novel is News from Paraguay. As you were writing about this war, the buildup of war in the United States was going on at the same time.
Right.
There were clear connections for you between looking at Paraguay and Franco and looking at Bush and Iraq.
Yep. You know, I was so against the war and I'm so against this administration, I can hardly speak about it.
Do you deal with more contemporary political themes in your short fiction?
Well, maybe not in my short fiction, but in Siam, the book takes place in Thailand just before the beginning of the Vietnam War. I don't want to compare myself to Graham Greene, but it's like The Quiet American, where the naivete of Americans, instead of helping, end up by making a big mess.
When I was reading about the cruelty in the prisons, the harsh life of everybody there, the way death is treated cavalierly, and then I hear about what's going on in different parts of the world, not just Iraq, and not just by the United States, I keep wondering, has the human race learned anything, even by the cleansing of World War II?
Probably not. Unfortunately, no, I don't know.
Let's go back and talk a little about Lily Tuck here. Had you always wanted to be a writer?
Yes, absolutely, ever since I was a child.
When you were growing up, at what point did you learn English?
I was 9. I went to school in New York City, and I didn't speak any English. I spoke French and Spanish at the time. I was in the 4th grade. I remember they were studying the Egyptians, and I don't think I opened my mouth the entire year. I mean, this was the day before sort of special ed and language, and I just sat, and as I said, I don't think I opened my mouth for a year, and until I could sort of speak proper English sentence, because I didn't want to be thought of as a foreigner or different or weird or anything.
Do you think that the fact that you already spoke 2 languages helped you in developing a voice that has no accent at all?
Maybe, yeah.
Did it surprise you that no accent emerged? Did you work very hard to make sure?
I don't remember working very hard, but I'm sure I probably did. My mother always spoke with this terrific accent, and she was very charming.
So you grew up in the late 40s and the 50s in New York City.
Right.
Did you write on the side?
I always wrote short stories and kept a diary, yep.
What did you do for work when you finally got out of college?
Well, actually, my first job was with Voice of America doing research. And then I had this idea that I could be a simultaneous interpreter at the UN. So, and that was a big mistake because I didn't last. That didn't work out. Then I worked for an organization called the United World Federalists, which was sort of an organization connected with the United Nations, and it was based on the idea of world peace through world law, which is a very nice idea, but it hasn't caught on, I'm afraid. I got married, and then I had 3 children, and I lived in Thailand with my first husband. Then we got divorced, and I lived not far from here. I went to live in Squaw Valley, and then I went back to Paris.
And now you're in New York again?
Now I'm in New York again.
And your first novel, was that interviewing Matisse?
Yes.
And what were the origins of writing that book?
The novel begins with a telephone conversation. It's sort of an epistolary novel, but on the telephone, between 2 women, 2 good friends, and one of them calls the other. One woman calls the other to tell her that a good mutual friend has died and has died standing up. And I did know somebody who died standing up, and I just think that's such a sort of strange thing. It's sort of the negation of death to be standing up, and that stayed in my head that was the beginning of the novel.
Did you have any trouble getting it published?
I didn't, because I was studying with a man called Gordon Lish at the time, who is a sort of controversial writing teacher, but he was also editor at Knopf, so he took the novel right away. The novel was published in 91.
And after that came The Woman Who Walked on Water.
Right, yeah.
And where's that set?
That's set in the Caribbean. And again, all but this last book, The News from Paraguay, a lot of my books start with some very strong image that stays in my head. The Woman Who Walked on Water, my husband and I were in the Caribbean, and we were having lunch, and we saw this woman, a very sort of beautiful, athletic woman, start to swim, and she had three dogs with her, three big dogs, and she swam very, very, very far out into the ocean, and so that you could just see sort of four dots. You couldn't tell who was the woman and who were the three dogs. And we asked the waiter about her, because it was such a sort of strange thing to see this woman swim so far out with her dogs. And he said, oh, yes, she comes every year and swims with her dogs. And it was there was something so very erotic about it, too. I mean, it's hard to explain. But anyway, so that was the first image in the book and the catalyst for the book.
And Siam had an image, too, then?
Didn't really. I lived in Thailand with my husband, my first husband, and we were, again, the naive, ignorant Americans. My former husband wanted to start a business there, and everybody thought he was in the CIA because he didn't have a proper job, and he wasn't, I'm sure, but it gave us a lot of freedom because people didn't ask us too many questions. A lot of our friends were in the military. They were building runways in Thailand, beginning of the build-up for the war, and nobody seemed concerned about it, or it's just sort of starting to happen without anybody talking about it.
What was your political consciousness like at the time?
I don't think I had much, frankly. I just horrified, but I don't think I had much. I think certainly now I feel very strongly about what's happening in this country. I don't consider myself a political writer, and I don't think one should have an agenda when one's writing, because I think that either dates the book or it sort of narrows the focus if you want to write about AIDS or feminism or something. I think it's better to stay on a sort of more general topic.
How do you feel about writing long fiction versus short?
I mean, I usually work on short stories in between novels, kind of as a respite. I like working on both, but I think writing a novel and having a book is more satisfying.
Do you write essays as well, nonfiction?
A few, not that many, but I have, yeah. I did a piece on getting divorced, on the writing life. I did a piece for the Washington Post. It was called Accuracy and Consistency. It's about writing accurately and consistently.
What do you mean by accurately and consistently?
About getting your facts right. There's nothing more disturbing that puts you off a book if the facts are wrong.
So how accurate, then, based upon your own essay, what grade do you give News from Paraguay?
I think the historical facts are completely accurate, although when I was in Paraguay, everybody kept pointing out things that I got wrong. Somebody pointed out to me that Ella Lynch probably would have never met Princess Mathilde, who she corresponds with, because they were a different class of society. The thing that made me start the article was the movie, I've just thought of this now, American Beauty. Annette Bening and
Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Spacey are having dinner in their dining room, and there are several pictures on the wall, and then you see them again in another scene having dinner. They're actually having a fight. I think somebody throws a plate of asparagus or something at each other, and the picture is gone. It's not on the wall, and you wonder.
Lily Tuck, what are you working on now?
I'm superstitious, so I can't say, but it's set in Italy, and I'm going to the American Academy in Rome for a month, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Is this also historical?
It takes place around World War II, so I don't know whether you consider that historical or not.
Do you do your research online, in libraries?
In libraries. I mean, I was lucky. I live in New York, so I spent most of my time for this book, for the News from Paraguay, in the New York Public Library. But if there's something that I just need to know quickly, like how a telegraph works, I look that up on the Internet, or how somebody amputates an arm, I look that up on the Internet, or, you know, or check it out with another source. But the Internet certainly is very helpful.
When you're doing the research, how does that change the nature of the book? In News from Paraguay, had you done all your research prior to the book, or as you were working on it, did you?
Yeah, no, I do research as I work, and it's much easier because then you don't have thousands of index cards and you don't forget what you learned 3 months ago. There's a passage where the two soldiers are fishing, Gaspar and Fulgencio, and they catch a huge fish, a huge catfish, and then they slit open its belly and they find this whole monkey inside the fish. And I read about that. Somebody, an Englishman actually, had gone to Paraguay and gone fishing and found a monkey in his fish. I mean, you feel like you're given a gift, kind of, when you find those details that you can use.
Lily Tuck, you've said your favorite writer is Joan Didion. Mm-hmm. Why?
I love her spare writing. I love how she sort of turns things around unexpectedly. I love Democracy. I love the Book of Common Prayer. I thought they were extraordinary books.
The National Book Award, 5, quote, unknowns mm-hmm. were nominated. What was your reaction when you found out you were one of them?
I was thrilled, of course, and then the controversy sort of started and the people objected because I don't know why exactly that we were unknown, that we hadn't sold enough books. People like Philip Roth had not been nominated, but in fact it was very good for the five of us because we sold a lot of books.
Lily Tuck, threaded through this interview with comments about what's been happening in the United States and abroad, what do you think, if any, is a writer's responsibility in terms of dealing with this, understanding full well that fiction is what it is and you don't want to make it too overt?
Right. I think that's a very difficult question. I actually had dinner with another writer last week, Susanna Moore, a writer I admire a lot, and we were saying that I don't think art makes a difference in the world. It really doesn't. When you look at Africa, the Sudan, I mean, does art make any difference to them? No. I mean, I think you do art because you feel you have to, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I don't know whether things change as a result. I mean,
do you think a lot of this has to do with just the general depression of what we've seen here in the past year?
That, but when you look at how many people suffer in the world, how many people don't have enough to eat or don't have shelter or don't have clothing, it's horrible. Does art help them?
But the question is, does art change minds? Does art transform things among the people who can make a difference?
If President Bush were to read this book instead of Tom Wolfe's book, would he identify with Francisco Solano Lopez? Would he think, oh dear, he started this unnecessary war? There's a lesson to be learned there? Probably not. I don't know. But I think maybe writers or artists, you should write or paint not just for the pleasure, but I don't really write to instruct anybody, I don't think. Perhaps a little bit. I like the idea that people now know where Paraguay is, but that wasn't my primary purpose in writing this book.
You've been listening to an interview with Lily Tuck, whose latest novel is News from Paraguay. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.